Hi, this is Joe Castellano. Welcome to the Inside China Basin Baseball Podcast on thesportsvirus.com, featuring players like all-star catcher Buster Posey.
It's about, you know, just going out and trying to have passion for the game that I've loved since I was a kid.
Inside China Basin is brought to you by Sun First Solar, known for delivering solar excellence since 1984 and recently voted best solar company in Marin County. We're also brought to you by TPC Harding Park, the only public golf course in San Francisco, offering golfers the opportunity to play where the pros play. Coming up, our special guest today is John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle, author of the new book, 24, Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid, a book he wrote with Willie Mays. But first, I want to tell you about our favorite golf course, TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. As I was thumbing through Golf Digest, I found that TPC Harding Park is recognized as one of the best places to play in America. And that didn't surprise me too much because I love the majestic layout and beautiful amenities. My San Francisco resident card gives me a great rate at TPC Harding Park, and I get to play where PGA Tour icons Jack Nicklaus, Phil Mickelson, and Tiger Woods have played. Now, if I can only score like them, okay, I'll stop dreaming and get to our guest.
There's a long drive, way back in center field, way back, back, it is caught! Willie Mays just brought this ground to its feet with a catch, which must have been an optical illusion to a lot of people.
And that was the 1954 World Series, the great catch by Willie Mays. I'm Joe Castellano. This is the sportsvirus.com Inside China Basin webcast podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Very special guest, a man who has authored a book about Willie Mays, 24 Life Stories and Lessons from the Say Hey Kid, John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle joining us. We're actually both in the same town. We're both in Novato, California, and we're talking to each other here on this great technology, the webcast podcast. John, thanks a lot for joining us. You must be like me. We're just missing being at the ballpark so much, so at least we could talk about baseball from our computers like this.
Yeah, it's a good call. We're supposed to have the opening weekend the past couple of days, but unfortunately, it's not coming anytime soon, and it's not coming in May. It's not coming in June. And who knows if it'll come in July or August. But once it does, man, it'll be magnificent.
Well, your book about Willie Mays is scheduled to come out on May the 5th, day before his birthday. Tell us about, you know, the book and, as far as it being released, no changes there, right?
Well, first of all, it's not my book. It's my book and Willie's book.
Right.
Right? Co-authors. I mean, we worked on this together. We worked on it for a long, long time. I remember talking to him maybe 15 years ago, Joe, and I said, Willie, what about a book? Are you up for a book? And he said, John, yes, but I'd like to see this book in classroom. So from there, we sort of went inspirational, all inspirational with life stories and life lessons. All throughout the book, it's got both. And it's been a project that's, well, it's a project of a lifetime, really. I mean, I've spent so many years with him, hanging out with him. And what an experience. I mean, who could say that? Why me, right? But he's really been into it. And I've met with him 15 or 20 times. And each time, instead of 2 or 3 hours, it's always like 5 to 7 hours. And we just hang out. We talk. Things come up. We brainstorm. We talk ball. We talk life. And from there, that was the genesis of the storytelling. And I've interviewed more than 200 people and always bring back those comments and reflections of his former teammates, his Negro League teammates, his childhood friends. And I bring those things back to Willie. And then, you know, he lights up and riffs from there. And from all of that is the book 24, broken down into 24 chapters. All about his life, his baseball career, and much more.
Well, all the quotes for this book came from your interviews. So they're exclusive interviews. And that's pretty unusual, isn't it, John? I mean, a lot of books, you see some quotes that come from maybe another book or another publication. But everything that you have in this book with you and Willie, those are exclusive interviews.
Right. You might go through an older Willie book and see a quote from Life magazine or the New York Times or Newsday or Jet magazine or some movie or some, you know, TV interview or whatever. And this has none of that. It's all new. It's all fresh. And speaking with his teammates, obviously they're in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And they reflect now, and it's just amazing, like it was yesterday. They remember pitch counts and base hits, where they went, situations. It's amazing, the recall for these ballplayers. And we're talking some of this stuff is 50 years ago, and they remember exactly what happened. And it's amazing because it's history. And I'm listening to this, and I'm recording it, and I'm documenting it, and chronicling it, and putting it in words and pictures. And it's really the opportunity of a lifetime, the project of a lifetime for me. I'm pinching myself every day. And in fact, 5 weeks from today, it's going to be released.
We'll have more with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle right after this. Jones goes back near the wall, shading the sun, and he dropped it. He lost the ball in the sun. Let's put the sun to good use at home with a SunPower residential solar system. Your SunPower elite dealer, SunFirst Solar, has a wide range of financing options, and they provide the finest customer service from start to finish, regardless of size or scope. SunFirst Solar offers the highest efficiency systems, newest technology, and the best warranty in the world. SunFirst Solar offers the most competitive price while not compromising on quality. This summer, let the sun heat your pool and eliminate your energy bill. Don't drop the ball. Call SunFirst Solar at 415-458-5870. That's 415-458-5870. And get your SunPower solar system today. Let's talk about when you went to Birmingham, Alabama, and Rickwood Field, which is actually, I believe that's the oldest field that still exists in professional baseball, you know, older than Wrigley Field or Fenway Park. I mean, of course, some stadiums have been, you know, torn down like a Candlestick Park. But you went back there, you did interviews. What kind of a thrill was that? What did you learn from that trip to Birmingham, Alabama, that you could tell us about so that we can get, you know, excited? I had a chance to read the book, but for those of the folks that are going to buy the book, what can they get excited about those stories?
Well, Willie Mays was born in Westfield, Alabama, a town that no longer exists, in 1931, May 6th. So he'll be 89 this coming May 6th, a day after the book comes out. And he grew up in Westfield. He grew up in nearby Fairfield, which is in nearby Birmingham. And these were mining towns, and these were segregated towns. And these were towns that, you know, Willie didn't have a lot, you know, of money, a lot of food, but he always thought he had plenty. He always had enough. He played with black kids. He played with white kids. It's a segregated city, one of the most racist cities in the country, going all the way into the 60s. When, you know, at the time, you asked about Rickwood Field. I spent almost every day of my week at Rickwood Field. This place is just gorgeous. All the other ballparks he played at, Candlestick Park, you mentioned, Seal Stadium, Shea Stadium, the Polo Grounds, they're all gone. The five ballparks he played in the major leagues, they're all gone. They're all leveled and replaced or just ignored. But Rickwood still is existing, and college teams play there. High school teams play there. Built in 1910. Once the old Comiskey Park was replaced in the early 90s, that's when this became number one among the oldest professional ballparks. And Willie played there. And I'm walking through the dugouts in the clubhouse. I walk out to center field where he roamed. I stood in the box where he swung away as a teenager. And remember, this was the Negro Leagues. This was the local team. This was, a team full of great ball players, but ball players who couldn't make it to the majors because maybe they were a little older. And at the time, the major leagues had these quotas. And, you know, we're not going to have one or three. It's always going to be two. So they roomed together. The Dodgers had four. So they weren't willing to sign a young Willie Mays. Imagine that, because they already had four major leaguers who were of color. As ridiculous as it sounds, that was reality at the time. And most teams didn't want anybody of color. just one by one, they started integrating. And the Red Sox, of course, not till 1959 with Pumpsy Green did they integrate 12 years after Jackie Robinson. So Willie has these wonderful stories of his teenage years playing with grown men, Piper Davis, his manager, and, you know, across the infield, across the outfield, just legendary people in Willie's life. And he still reflects back at them now as very inspirational people in his upbringing.
You know, you mentioned the racism that everybody had to deal with back then. And we hear a lot about Jackie Robinson because, of course, he broke the color barrier. But for Willie Mays, it wasn't easy as well, especially in his minor league career early on. You told some stories in there. You know, Willie, I would think, remembers those stories vividly, right?
Yeah. In fact, he graduated from high school. There were about five or six teams that were interested in him to some degree. Obviously, the Red Sox scouted him. They weren't interested in him. They filed phony reports about how he wasn't our kind of ball player. And read into that as you may. The Dodgers sent a guy named Whit Matthews who said Willie couldn't hit the curveball. I mean, really? The Chicago White Sox, the New York Yankees, the other Boston team, the Braves. They were all interested to some degree, but only the Giants paid what he wanted and made him feel comfortable in signing with the New York Giants. So shortly after high school, and think of this, I mean, Willie is in an all-black league, obviously the Negro Leagues. And once he signs, he goes and plays in Trenton, New Jersey, which is not far from the Polo Grounds in New York. That way management can monitor him and see how he's doing. He's not only the only black guy on the team, he's the only black guy in the league. So imagine that culture shock going from the Birmingham Black Barons to the Trenton Giants overnight. And right away, fans are all over him. I mean, this is just 3 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. And then Willie broke in the following year, just 4 years after Jackie broke the barrier. So he goes from town to town in the Deep South. Some of these, Hagerstown, Maryland, below the Mason-Dixie line. And it was rough. It was rough that first year. And then the next year, he starts with Minneapolis, a double-A team that was integrated. So it was much easier for him. He had African-American teammates, and he was hitting .477 in May, and he really hit himself into the major leagues as a 20-year-old kid. And then, you know, we know the rest of the story. 1951, suddenly, you know, he's in the World Series and part of the greatest comeback in baseball history with Bobby Thompson's home run at the Polo Grounds.
Yeah, and I want to get to that year. But first, you know, going back a little bit to when he was scouted, and the scout that signed him for the San Francisco Giants, Eddie Montague's dad, Eddie Montague, the longtime umpire, his dad signed Willie Mays. And can you imagine back in those days, those other teams passing up on Willie Mays? I mean, that just was part of the remarkable part of the book to read that, you know, all these other teams must have had really big regrets.
Mistake of a lifetime for all these scouts, all these teams. The Boston Red Sox, Willie speaks of the most, because that was the team that had a double-A affiliate in Birmingham that played at Rickwood Field. So they had more access to Willie. They could monitor him more than any team in the majors. They totally blew it. In fact, Willie tells me stories about how he used to hang out with the owners and the GM of the team at the time. So that was an easy decision for the Red Sox at the team. But Tom Yawkey, one of the most racist owners of all time, and the GM at the time, Joe Cronin, who's from San Francisco roots, they did not want a young Willie Mays on the Boston Red Sox. And that's a big reason the Red Sox were pretty awful during much of Willie Mays' career. They took so long to realize that we're stupid. Let's move on. It's not 1938. It's not 1948. Come on. So anyway, they finally get Pumpsy Green, and it, you know, they're still not good for a long, long time, as history will tell you. But yeah, you go back to those days at Birmingham, and Rickwood Field is just about 10,000 people, and it's right in the heart of a neighborhood. You could walk there from downtown still. And at the time, Willie and people who were there at the time, everyone tells me how just it was the place to be. Like I said, the double-A team for the Red Sox shared the ballpark, owned the ballpark, and the Black Barons rented the ballpark. So if the White Barons, I'll call them the White Barons, if they were on the road, the Black Barons would play at Rickwood Field. The following weekend, the Black Barons would be on the road playing Negro League opponents throughout the South and East, and the White Barons would come in. So it's just crazy to think, but Willie tells a story about when the Black Barons were playing, all the white folks would go beyond the right field wall to watch the game. And then when the White Barons would play, the black customers would go out beyond. It's just one little segregated area where you could stay. But it's just so hard to believe, and this ballpark still exists. And the Barons, there's a team called the Birmingham Barons still today. It's a double-A team for the Chicago White Sox. And they have a much nicer downtown ballpark, but they use this game, they use this field once a year for like a throwback game to have another team in town. So it's kind of cool to walk around this place, but it's just amazing that Willie Mays is telling these stories now that I never knew, and I thought I knew everything about Willie.
Well, yeah, to go through it as a black ball player during that time had to be difficult. And his dad really made sure that he was sort of protected by, whether it be friends or Monty Irvin took him under his wing when he made it to the Giants in 1951. And that was interesting when he first came up because he didn't hit very well. I think he was, one for his first 22, something like that. And you wondered whether or not at the time they wondered if he was brought up too soon. But Leo DeRocher really believed in him. I mean, Willie even said something about how he didn't even want to come up. He wanted to stay in Minneapolis because he was rolling there. And he didn't know if he was ready yet. But Leo DeRocher really felt that he was.
Yeah, he was 0-for-12 until he got his first hit, a home run at the Polo Grounds against Warren Spahn, who has more wins by a left-handed pitcher than anyone in history, and the Hall of Famer. And Willie hit more home runs against this guy than anybody. He hit his first. He hit the home run at Candlestick Park to end that 1-0 16-inning game between Spahn and Maréchal. And I think he opened the 1962 season. First swing was against Spahn. And that was also a home run. So here's a guy, one of the best pitchers of all time, and Willie has his number. A young Willie has his number. But you're right. He didn't have but one hit the first several games and was crying in the clubhouse at his locker. And Leo comes up and says, "Hey, man, I don't care if you hit at all. The way you play defense, the way you run in the outfield and make plays, you're saving our pitching staff. And it doesn't matter if you're going to get another hit, but you just stay and keep playing defense." And from there, Willie got comfortable and started hitting. Now, he didn't have a great offensive year as a rookie, though he was Rookie of the Year. You know, he hit, in the 260s, 270s, but everybody knew just from watching him. I mean, you had to keep your eye on this kid because he was just a natural, and you wanted to make sure to watch him. And, when he ran across the field, you just didn't leave your seat. You wanted to watch this kid. And then, obviously, he was in the military for 2 years and didn't come back until 1954. And that's when he really took over the game as the MVP in the National League.
It's great the detail that you go into, John, in the book, because you've got the 51 playoff with the Dodgers, the Bobby Thompson home run. You've got the catch in 54, and you go through great detail on that catch. I mean, he takes Willie Mays takes us through that catch with every detail that comes to mind. And you had, Vic Wertz hitting that ball deep and people thinking there's no way that he's going to catch that ball. And then how important it was to Willie to get that ball back into the infield, thinking that the runner that was at second base could score on that.
Yeah, you're right. This was the powerhouse Cleveland Indians. Everyone was expecting a sweep by Cleveland, not by the Giants. And, it was 2-2 in the eighth inning. And the Giants were holding tight, and the big Vic Wertz comes up with Al Rosen at first and Larry Doby at second, and hits a ball about 900 feet, thinking, okay, that's either a three-run homer or a two-run double or a two-run triple. But either way, the Indians are up 4-2. Well, here comes Willie Mays dancing and across the outfield at the Polo Grounds. And not only does he make the catch, but his first thought is, well, I got this. But now how am I going to get the ball back to the infield so they don't score? And that's what was going through his mind during those 6 seconds in which the ball was hit until the time that the throw was made. And when the throw was made, the runners were stunned, the fans were stunned, the teammates were stunned, everybody was stunned. Willie throws a perfect strike to second base, and Al Rosen has to retrieve to first base, and all Larry Doby could do was tag and go to third. And then the Giants got out of it, and they won in extra innings, Dusty Rhodes with a home run, and that was the genesis of a four-game sweep. So, you know, I kind of relate it. Remember when Pablo Sandoval hit those three home runs against Detroit in game one against the team that was supposed to kill the Giants in the World Series, overmatched in every way? You know, at the most, the Tigers were going to beat the Giants in 5 games. Well, Pablo hits three home runs and in the opener, and the Giants cruise. And that's kind of what happened in 54 when Mays made that catch, because that was the beginning of a sweep, you know, all those years earlier.
It's funny because, you know, and we've heard this before, that wasn't the best catch Willie Mays ever made. I mean, it was in the World Series, so of course it gets all of the publicity that it deserves. But there were other catches that he made that he thought were more incredible. Others thought were maybe more incredible. The thing about the catch in the 54 World Series is that he knew he had it all the way, and even some of his teammates knew, because he hit, you know, he tapped his glove as if to say, yeah, I've got this one. And even though he's running way, way out there, he knew he had it.
And I spoke with people who were in the ballpark that day. Johnny Antonelli was a pitcher who was going to go game two. He was in the dugout. Joey Amalfitano was on that team. He's still with the Giants, working in the minor leagues. He was there warming up guys in the bullpen. And I'm sure you know this, but back then, the Polo Grounds, it was just like a big oval stadium. Center field was way out there. And it was so big that they were actually able to put the bullpens on the field and never really worry about, you know, a ball going out there because it's so far away. And, you know, sure enough, this ball almost hit the bullpens. But, yeah, so all these Al Rosen, you know, I spoke with, you know, who has passed, saying that, you know, only Al Rosen had a great quote. He says, you know, he was the only one that could have made that play at that time at that ballpark. And if you think about it, the catch can never be repeated because nobody has a ballpark like the Polo Grounds. Any ball hit like that today is going to be easily a center field homer. I mean, the Tigers have a ballpark, which is the deepest center field in the majors. But, you know, add another 40 feet and now you're talking the Polo Ground. So it only Willie Mays could have made that catch. And then the next, you know, a few years later when they moved to San Francisco, they play at Seal Stadium, and Willie used to complain and says, I can make all these catches, but they got the wall out there.
It's funny because, yeah, you're right. It'll never happen again like that. And I'm glad you mentioned Joey Amalfitano. You quoted him a lot in the book. And it was really interesting when Willie Mays had the four home run game, because Joey Amalfitano was a big part of that. It looked like Willie wasn't going to play back on April the 29th, 1961. He was sick. He had eaten some ribs that I guess didn't agree with him. So he rarely sat down, but he was going to sit down that game. And then Joey Amalfitano gave him one of his bats, and I guess he liked it a lot, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of playing a lot, he didn't come out. Think of this stat. He came up in 51, and through the 62 season, all those years later, he missed 21 games. 21 games. So listen to this stat. He played 150-plus games for 11 straight years. And most of those years were during 154-game seasons before they went to 162. And it's just amazing. So he never came out of the lineup. So when he was hurting, you had to say, okay, man, take a break. If you're hurting, it must be serious. So the night before, he and McCovey were out, late into the night, having some ribs, sharing some ribs. And Willie Mays did not feel, you know, good all night. He was thrown up. And In the morning, he just said, hey, I can't play. You know, I just can't play. Elvin Dark was the manager. And so he said, okay, no problem. So he's going to sit out. And then Amalfitano comes up to him and says, well, are you kind of okay? Or you just, I mean, he says, no, I just can't play. I said, well, on a scale of 1 to 100, what are you? He said, well, 75. And Amalfitano says, well, if you're 75, that's better than everybody else's 100.
Right.
And he says, try this bat. So Amalfitano gives him a little lighter bat. And Willie says, all right, I'll go. So he went out to take some batting practice, hit about 6 or 7 home runs over the wall, and says, oh, man, I do feel pretty good. And it was a little lighter bat that Amalfitano used. And Amalfitano said it was heavy for him, and he used it during BP just to get loose. And so you know, Willie used big old bats and heavy bats. And this particular bat was legendary because without that bat, Willie doesn't have the best game of his career. And a funny side story to that is both those guys thought that bat was gone. And because they moved on to Chicago. This game was in Milwaukee. They moved to Chicago the next series, and Willie hits a ball, cracks the bat, and they figure, oh, that's it. Amalfitano put it up at his locker, and they thought somebody swiped it, and some kid, you know, put some nails in it and goes out and hits the ball, lost forever. But doing a little research for this book, we actually found the bat. And we found where it is, and that's a pretty cool story. And when Amalfitano and Willie heard that we know where the bat is, they were just amazed.
Yeah, Cooperstown. That's what I saw in your book, Cooperstown. Wow,
yeah,
what a place for the bat to be, right?
And nobody, it's not like Cooperstown promoted this in a big way, but, you know, down in the dungeon or wherever they keep some things they don't have on display, there's Willie's bat. They also have the glove that Willie used to catch, to make that catch off Vic Wirtz. So, like, two of the biggest items in Willie's career, Cooperstown has.
Our conversation with John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle continues in just a moment. We all know that solar systems make financial sense and environmental sense. And when it comes to choosing the best installation crew in the business, Sun First Solar should be your first choice. Sun First Solar has provided solar excellence since 1984. They are SunPower Elite Commercial and Elite Residential installers with a reputation for technical excellence, innovative design, fair pricing, excellent customer service, and end-to-end quality and competence. Sun First Solar is a family business devoted to treating their employees, customers, the community, and the environment with respect, and they are devoted to renewable energy and sustainability throughout the Bay Area. There is no roof or project that is too complicated. Sun First has successfully installed solar on Spanish tile roofs, metal roofs, and very steep roofs. They also have extensive experience in solar ground mounts and solar pool heating. Competitive pricing, expert consultation, and the best warranty. Go local and get your Sun Power solar system from Sun First Solar today. Call Sun First Solar at 415-458-5870. That's 415-458-5870. You know, you mentioned the durability for Willie Mays, and Mickey Mantle was not as durable. We know about the knee injury, and you know, he was banged up a lot, but there were always the comparisons, and I didn't realize how friendly they were. You know, they were good friends, and you know, you think about Willie, Mickey, and the Duke, and the song, and all that, and all three guys got along really well, right?
Yeah, and people say, "Well, what about the Duke? He's like the third guy, the fifth Beatle." Say, "Well, not really, man. If you look at Duke Snider's numbers from the time Willie came back from the military in 1954 until the Dodgers and Giants played their final year in New York in 1957, he was every bit the hitter that Willie and Mickey were. So that was a legitimate debate in, you know, the boroughs of New York and during all those years, because he could hit with those guys no problem, but he just didn't run the bases and field like those guys. Obviously, Willie says that Mickey is one of the fastest runners, and this is after the knee blew out in the 51 series, that he's ever seen. Him and Veda Pinson, he said, were the two fastest runners he's seen in baseball throughout his whole career. So yeah, they were tight. They grew up in the South in the same year in 31. They broke in the same year in 51. They played the same position. They played in the same city. And, you know, Willie and tells funny stories about Mickey that they always talked to each other. If one guy was getting 105,000, then the next guy wanted to ask for 106. So they had this running gag. And then after their playing days, they got together a lot during autograph shows and old timers games. So they became really, really close, and checked in on each other during their playing days, Obviously, they saw each other every year at All-Star games and a couple times during the World Series. But yeah, they were tighter than I ever thought. And you know, Willie tells a great story about his last conversation with Mickey shortly before Mickey passed. So they were tight, and Willie gets really emotional when talking about Mickey.
Now, Mays, at the end of his career, he went to the New York Mets, and I remember that vividly, John, as a kid who was living in New Jersey back in 1972, 73, when Mays was playing there. And I'll show you here for our webcast viewers. This is an autographed photo I got of Willie Mays when he was a Met. I used to write the Mets players, and then they would answer with, an autographed photo. I mean, it was incredible. I don't know that players
really
do that.
Did Willie sign that?
Yeah.
Willie signed that photo.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Beautiful.
It's pretty cool. My mom actually dug that out for me, so we're going to thank my mom today. So, and my brother, Tom, by the way, who's producing this webcast. But, I think that as a Met, when you think about those days, you think that, okay, it's the end of his career. He's not as good. You think about the argument at home plate when Bud Harrelson, many people thought that he was safe against the A's in the World Series. And you see the photo of Mays just, bewildered that out call was made when he thought it was a safe call. And then there's the fly ball out in the outfield in Oakland where he loses it in the sun. And so there are these images and these memories, and it doesn't tell the whole story like your book does, John, because in the book, you quoted Ed Cranepool and Jerry Kuzman and what they thought of Willie Mays.
Yeah, we're talking about the 1973 World Series. It's Willie's last year. He's with the Mets, and the Oakland A's are in the World Series, and it goes seven games. And everybody remembers these pictures of Willie on his knees, complaining to the umpire and thinking, well, boy, that must have been an awful play he made. Oh, that must have been an awful call he got at the plate. Well, it's none of that. He was on his knees arguing with Augie Donatelli, the umpire, going after the umpire in defense of a teammate, because all the Mets thought that the play at the plate, should have been in the Mets' favor. And Ray Fosse was the catcher at the time, and he tells me to this day, no, he was out. But yeah, there was a big argument, and people say, well, you don't want to be like Willie Mays. You don't want to play beyond your years. So I said, you know what? I'm going to look into this. I'm going to talk to the people to see if the people who were there at the time believe that. And I couldn't find anybody. I mean, Willie Mays hardly played at all in the final 2 months of the season because of injuries. It was the first time in his career he was ever on the disabled list. And he was hurting. He was 41, 42 years old. And Joan Payson, the owner of the Mets, wouldn't let Willie retire. And Willie says, okay, finally, at the end of the season, but Willie and Joan said, just play out the season, please, for me. So anyway, his teammates swore by him, saying, he's the best athlete we've ever seen. And, he's in his final year. He and Seaver got along, and Cranepool, Kuzman, like you said, they were like his best friends. And they looked out for Willie, made sure that, he was fine, that the clubbies were taking care of him, and the fans didn't, get on his case, and everyone just seemed to be in his corner. But when you look back at that, say, well, he missed some balls in the outfield, and he hadn't played center field in over a month, and there was an injury, and they asked Willie to play center field in the first couple of games, and he said that's fine, but he came in game two, which went extra innings, and this game went on forever. And it was at the Coliseum, and it was a little later start. So you had the shadows and you had the sun. And I talked to people who were there, from Raleigh Fingers to Reggie Jackson to a couple of Mets to other A's, and they all say that day was like the worst sun ever. And, Willie goes out there and lost a couple balls in the sun. If it happened to him when he was 25 or 30, nobody would have ever thought about it. But it's in his final season. But anyway, the bottom line of the story, in that game where he lost a couple balls in the sun, and people from there said, you don't want to be Willie Mays, you don't want to play beyond. He got the game-winning hit to beat the A's in game two. And the A's eventually won in seven games. But anyway, Willie Mays was a big part of the Mets being there. And the Mets actually, extending the series, because they went back to New York played three games and then came back and lost in seven games at the Coliseum. So, and by the way, when Willie was introduced before game one at the Coliseum, first time he ever was in Oakland at that ballpark, he got like a 3 or 4 minute standing ovation.
Wow.
So, you know, these are A's fans, not necessarily Giant fans, but, you know, Mets fans, A's fans. And the guy who got the biggest ovation was the guy who, was introduced as, is Willie Mays in one of his final introductions.
Yeah, and how about the fact that his first hit as a Met was against the Giants? That was pretty cool.
Against the Giants, a home run, right?
Yeah. I want to finish up by talking a little bit about Barry Bonds because they had a good relationship. Willie Mays kind of took care of Barry Bonds when he was a little kid, growing up playing baseball. You know, he was his godfather. Really a special relationship that they had. What were some of the inside stories that you got out of that?
Well, I wrote a chapter about not only Willie and Barry, but Willie, Barry, and Bobby. Bobby Bonds, Barry's father, Willie kind of mentored Bobby long before he mentored Barry, because Bobby came up and he was supposed to be, the next Willie Mays, just like Bobby Mercer in New York was supposed to be, the next Mickey Mantle. And how much pressure do you think that could be on somebody? So anyway, Willie said, don't mind that. Don't bother with any of those comments. And, just be you. Just be Bobby Bonds. Anyway, Bobby really looked up to Willie and told young Barry about him every day and told him, this is the guy you want to emulate. This is the guy you want. So Barry talks about how he used to go out to Candlestick when he was 6, 7 years old and follow Willie around because that's what the old man asked him to do. And Barry loved Willie. And, he'd go out and shag with them. He'd hang out his locker, steal all his bubble gum. And Willie took a liking to this kid. Bobby had three sons, but Barry hung around the ballpark more than any of those kids. So, all these years later, Bonds, the younger, is playing with the Giants, and there's Willie again. And while Barry goes through all the legal stuff with the steroid scandal and the Balco case, Willie's at his corner every day. I saw it. And, there were times he was at his locker. There were times they'd go into, separate quarters and talk. A couple times I saw Willie stretching out Barry in the middle of the room. And, Willie, when Barry was going after some of these records, Willie would follow him on the road. So all these guys telling me about the relationship, and it was pretty unique. And then obviously when Barry to this day says the biggest home run he's ever hit was the one that tied Willie, not past Willie, but tied Willie at 660. That's when Willie gave him the torch, literally the Olympic torch, behind the plate in a quick ceremony. He gave him a torch, to celebrate the moment. And they still talk a lot. And, it's a relationship that goes back many decades because, of the father. And when Bobby died of cancer shortly before he did, Willie was at the hospital talking with him. And, at his deathbed, Bobby basically told Willie, said, "Hey, keep an eye on Barry for me. You're the one guy that, he'll listen to."
Tell you, John, this is just a great book, and it's an outstanding time to have the book, I think, too, because I'll tell you, I think more people are reading books right now with the shelter in place situation. I know I've been reading more books than I have in the last decade, so I think the timing is great. It comes out on May the 5th. Really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're into heroes, if you're into American heroes, if you're into history, if you're into baseball, if you're into sports, if you're into stories about people who overcame great odds and became mentors to many, this might fit into all those categories. Children's book, young adults, old timers who might want to reminisce. He wanted to make sure this would, be great for kids, but also be great for all the generations. He speaks about that. So, yeah, it's kind of a project, like I said, for the ages that I pinch myself every day about. And you're right. Maybe it's a diversion at this point during our uncertain times here. So, unfortunately, Willie won't be out there signing a lot of books, but maybe we were going to, but still, it's going to be in place. And there's a wonderful audio book coming out as well. And Bob Costas, wrote just a fabulous foreword. And for the audio book, he actually reads his foreword. And we got a couple of people to read the book. And then at the end of the audio book, Willie and I do a pretty cool Q&A.
Well, I can't wait to hear all of that, John. Great job. Thank you so much for the time. 24 life stories and lessons from the Say Hey Kid, John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks a lot for doing the webcast and podcast. You're so technologically ahead of the game. You're ahead of the curve. I'll tell you, John. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was a pleasure, Joe. Thanks a lot.
That's John Shea from the San Francisco Chronicle. Join us again next week for another edition of Inside China Basin. For now, I'm Joe Castellano. Thanks for listening on thesportsvirus.com.
Say hey, fellas, what's your name?
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swinging at the plate, say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid is great. When he hits the ball, it's long gone, man. Hits it farther than camp began. Swings the bat like a little lead pipe. When they reach the ball, it's overripe. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swing it at the plate. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid is great.
He runs the bases like a choo-choo train. Swings around second like an aeroplane. His cap flies off when he passes third, and he heads home like an eagle bird.
Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie. Say hey,
say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid is great.
Yes, he covers center like he had jet shoes. The other batters get the Willie blues. Anything hit his way is out. Man, it just don't pay those guys to clout.
Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. Say hey.
Say who?
Swinging at the plate. Say hey.
Say who?
Say Willie. That giant kid is